morning, this is AM. I'm Michael Brissenden. A report being released by the Human Rights Commission today will reveal concerning evidence about the impact of detention on children. Two paediatricians who assessed the mental and physical health of children detained at the Wickham Point Detention Facility in Darwin have found they were among the most traumatised they'd seen in their 50 years of combined professional experience. The report is being released a day after the High Court ruled Australia's offshore detention regime at Nauru and Manus Island is lawful. The ruling clears the way for the government to return around 267 asylum seekers currently residing in Australia, including 37 babies and 54 children, to Nauru. To discuss this, I'm joined in the studio by Immigration Minister Peter Dutton. Peter Dutton, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Michael.
First of all, the High Court has ruled that the offshore detention regime is lawful. So just to be clear, you will be sending those asylum seekers back and the children back to Nauru?
Michael, the same principle will apply into the future as it has in the past, and that is that if people have acute medical needs and they come to Australia, then those needs will be met. We'll provide the medical support, as you would expect from a compassionate country like Australia, and then at the end of that medical support, when the doctors and the department deem that it's appropriate for that person to return to Nauru, that will be the policy continuing. And I think it's very important to send a very clear message, that is that we're not going to put children into harm's way. We're going to work individually through each of the cases. I think the most important point out of this too is that of the 250 plus people, many of those people have come down with family members that have required medical assistance. For example, a mother who has a complication in terms of her pregnancy, requires specialist obstetric services, could have that baby delivered in Australia, but we would bring the family members down with that person. So amongst the 267, there are many family members that haven't required medical assistance, but nonetheless have accompanied somebody that does.
Okay, let's talk about the children, because that's where the focus clearly is. The focus of much of the opposition to this clearly is. This report written by doctors working for the Human Rights Commission that will be released today says, the children, as I said, are among the most traumatised we've ever seen in our 50 years of combined professional experience. That's a pretty extraordinary statement, isn't it?
Well, Michael, I've made it my business from day one to get kids out of detention, and I've said, and I repeat again today, that I want to be the minister that gets children out of detention. There were 8,000 children who were in detention when Labor was in power. The number peaked at any one time at 2,000, and the number today is less than 80, and okay, I want to get it to zero.
But the fact is, you are going to send these kids back to Nauru when these children, apparently, according to this report, talk openly of self-harm and suicide. They have, quote, palpable anticipatory trauma at the mention of return of Nauru. Now, surely there's a better way. Yes, you don't want people drowning at sea, but it's simply cruel, isn't it, to send these traumatised kids back to Nauru?
Michael, the arrangements that we have in place, as I said to you before, is to look at the individual cases. If there are exceptional circumstances in individual cases, then we're happy to look at that. And that's always been the case. We've brought people from Nauru if there is additional medical support needed, and we've provided that to them. So that will continue. But I just make this point. There were 1,200 people who drowned at sea, including women and children, the voices of whom have never been heard. We're seeing in Europe at the moment the same outcome and millions of people flowing across borders. When I talk about getting children out of detention in Australia and trying to provide medical support in a first world country like ours, people smugglers in Indonesia are messaging out that if you have children, get on a boat now because you will settle in Australia and Dutton will release you out into the community. So we have to be compassionate on the one hand, but we have to be realistic about the threat from people smugglers, and we're going to continue our vigilance against people smugglers whilst providing compassion to those that have been traded in this evil people smuggling organised criminal syndicate.
But it must be difficult for you, clearly. I mean, you've got doctors, health professionals, church leaders, now the Human Rights Commission also, all of them urging you not to return these very traumatised children. Now, the UN Human Rights Commission, in a separate statement that's also come out this morning, I'm sure you've seen it, sending these children to Nauru could contravene Australia's obligations under the Convention of the Rights of the Child. We remind Australia that children, regardless of their legal status, have the right to be treated as children first and foremost, and urge Australia to ensure that the principle of the best interests of the child takes precedence over migration management or administrative considerations.
Well, Michael, we're acting in the best interest not only of these children, but children that would follow them, and that's the issue. I don't want to reopen the open border policy, and many of the advocates that you speak of are completely opposed to any border protection measures at all. They want a free arrangement where people could come to our country at any time. But the government is not going to.
Well, they're also clearly motivated by the welfare of these children.
I've addressed that because I'm not going to put children into harm's way. I've said that. I've said that we'll provide medical attention, as we have in the past, to those children that are in need. But I also think there is a lot of hype and scare in this campaign in relation to what's actually happening on Nauru. There is the fact that it is a very different situation on Nauru than when Labor was in government, because there is no detention on Nauru. There is a 24/7 open centre arrangement. Some families decide to stay within the centre because there are meals provided, medical support, education.
But they can't leave Nauru.
Well, they can. They can leave the centre, so they're not detained there, and there's accommodation provided for them on island. But the important point here is, Michael, that for the families that have been found not to be refugees, we have offered generous settlement packages to return to the country of origin, because through the legal process, it's been deemed that they are not refugees to whom Nauru owes protection, or to whom, in other cases, Australia owes protection. And in that circumstance, we provide support to people to return to their country of origin. And frankly, some people who are offering out false hope to say that this could be successfully challenged in the court, or the government's going to change its position, they are prolonging the situation of many of these families, and it's not helping the families, and it's not helping the general approach to these issues, which is to try and sort matters out quickly. If people are owed protection, that's fine. If they're not, then we want to provide them with support to go back to their country of origin.
Okay, you keep saying you won't send anyone back to harmful situations, but this is a situation where we simply have to trust you on this, don't we? Because there are claims, as you know, of sexual assaults every 13 days.
Well, I addressed that yesterday on the ABC, so I'm sorry that you repeat it again today, because it's a false claim.
Okay, but can you understand that the public might be a bit sceptical about this?
No, because I can understand.
There's very little information about what's going on there.
If people are led to believe things that aren't true, then that is a different situation.
But at one point, the government, for instance, publicly claimed it had received information that Save the Children charity workers were coaching asylum seekers to self-harm, and then it turned out that the Human Rights Commission says there was no evidence that this happened.
Well, again, I mean, that's a report that came out some weeks ago. I think the issue today...
I know it's a report came out some weeks ago, but this is about a matter of trust, and about the government saying that these people are not going to be sent into harm's way, and that you do have their best interests. So I'm just trying to underline that perhaps people are sceptical about that because we don't know very much about what's been going on there.
Michael, the only point that I would make is that in relation to that particular issue, which has been investigated, happened before my time in this portfolio, it was a very different situation on Nauru some years ago when there were 1,000 people a week arriving on boats, and Labor had tents set up in a very difficult situation where it was open for people to be assaulted, for there to be a lack of order within the centres, and Labor admits that. They admit that they got it wrong. And what we've been able to do is, as I say, reduce the number of children down to less than 80 in detention. I want to make sure that number can get to zero, but I don't want the 13 of the 17 detention centres that we've closed that Labor had reopened to be needed again. And I don't want the boats to start. And all of the intelligence to me suggests that people smugglers are trying again to get people onto boats. And we're not going to allow that situation to arise.
Okay. Just quickly on another matter, on the GST issue, which is around this morning.
Sure.
Reports are emerging that many of your colleagues are getting a bit nervous about this. Pretty clear that some are worried, particularly marginal seat holders. Is it time to put some concrete proposals on the table and stop this bleeding?
Michael, I think what the government's doing through Treasurer Morrison, who I think is doing a very good job, is explaining what the government wants to do, and that is to relieve the tax burden from middle Australians who are working hard, who are trying to provide for their families. If there is a way in which we could deliver tangible tax cuts to those people, then I think that's the debate that's underway. And these things will be fleshed out in due course, and that's a matter for the Treasurer and the Prime Minister. But the government's made no decision or commitment.
I think this is part of the problem for some of them, though, isn't it?
I think it's important, as the Treasurer has pointed out, that we need to proceed the debate with some information about what the government's motive is, and that is that we want to provide support to families who are working harder and paying more tax. We want to relieve that burden so that they've got more money to support their families. And we want to provide stimulus to small business so that they can employ more people and help grow the economy. And the government's adamant about that approach. And the Prime Minister and the Treasurer, no doubt, when a decision is made, will provide more detail. But we have committed to tax reform going into this election, and no doubt the detail will be provided as soon as possible.
Okay, Peter Dutton, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Michael. Thank
That's Immigration Minister Peter Dutton there. A number of churches across Australia are opening their doors as sanctuaries for asylum seekers facing removal back to those offshore detention centres. The High Court yesterday rejected a challenge, as we know, to the legality of Australia's offshore detention centres. That ruling means that the asylum seekers who came to Australia for medical treatment could be returned to either Nauru or Manus Island, as we've heard. One of Australia's senior Anglican leaders says places of worship are entitled to offer sanctuary to those seeking refuge from brutal and oppressive forces. Michael Edwards has this report.
The High Court's ruling is a bitter blow to the more than 250 asylum seekers who now fear being sent back to Nauru or Manus Island. Among them are 37 babies. Advocates for the asylum seekers are running a public campaign to pressure the government to let them stay in Australia. And now a number of religious leaders have come forward to offer them sanctuary in their churches and cathedrals. Reverend Dr. Peter Catt is the Anglican Dean of Brisbane. He's opening up St. John's Cathedral in Brisbane.
Many of us are at the end of our tether as a result of what seems like the government's intention to send children to Nauru. So we're reinventing or rediscovering or reintroducing the ancient concept of sanctuary as a last ditch effort to offer some sense of hope to those who must be feeling incredibly hopeless.
Sanctuary is a historical concept, and Dr. Catt says he'll happily risk being prosecuted for offering it.
Sanctuary was a concept that was certainly alive in the Middle Ages, when people could go to a church, and particularly to a cathedral, and claim sanctuary, and the church authorities could really grant safety against the civic authorities. It was a way of saying, I'm entering into God's territory away from the civic authorities that are oppressing me, and the oppressors generally accepted that the church could offer sanctuary to people.
Do you know what status it has under Australian law?
It's never been tested under Australian law, but my hunch is that if the authorities chose to enter the church and take people away, that would probably be a legal action. So this is really a moral stand, and it wouldn't be a good look, I don't think, for someone to enter a church and to drag people away.
The Australian Church's Refugee Task Force says the offers of help are coming from across Australia. Misha Coleman is the Executive Director of the Task Force.
Logistically, it will be quite a challenge to even get to these sanctuaries, but if they do, the relevant priest or vicar will manage that situation in a very sort of confidential way.
And that is Shen Narayanasamy, the Human Rights Director at GetUp, ending Michael Edwards' report. And you're listening to AM Around Australia, where it's 23 minutes past 7. A strong view against any GST increase is building among Federal Coalition MPs, as we heard earlier in our interview with Peter Dutton. The Prime Minister has left the prospect of a higher tax on the table, but after only a few days back in Canberra, the MPs who are opposed to a 15% GST have been talking to their colleagues and declare the sentiment is widely shared. Some worry about the political risk, others say it would harm their goals of achieving smaller government. Political correspondent Louise Yaxley reports.
One MP who's been talking to more than 20 colleagues says there's less and less appetite for lifting the GST and warns the strength of that view shouldn't be underestimated. Some fear the potential damage, reflecting that 18 coalition seats fell to Labor in the 1998 GST election. And they say lifting the tax from 10 to 15% is a 50% increase that voters won't accept as fair. Natasha Griggs holds the Darwin-based seat of Solomon by just over 1% and says other MPs have taken soundings from her.
We're all in Canberra for the first sittings of the year. We've had Labor actively campaigning in all of our seats over the Christmas period, scaremongering if you like, and so I don't think it's anything to be afraid of to talk about what's happening in your electorate. And Territorians are concerned because we already have a high cost of living. So we want to make sure that any change that occurs in the whole tax system is not detrimental to Territorians.
Liberal Luke Howarth holds the most marginal coalition electorate, Petrie, in Brisbane, but says he's not daunted by that.
At the end of the day, governments are elected to government, so I can't sort of look at my own individual seat and go, oh, this would be bad for me, and, well, you know, let's all freeze up and not do anything and sit around and not do anything. At the end of the day, we want to improve things for the Australian community.
Mr Howarth isn't ruling out backing a GST increase, but says other taxes would have to be cut.
Now, I don't believe that we should be increasing taxes to spend more. I'm happy if there's changes to tax. So if they say, well, for example, we're going to increase this area of tax, but we're also going to maybe cut payroll tax, or we're going to reduce income tax or something like that, and that's reasonable if there's changes to it, but not an overall increase in tax burden. We believe in lower taxes and smaller government, so we certainly don't want to increase taxes for the sake of increasing taxes.
The economic conservatives opposing a higher GST are worried about the compensation that would be required for low-income earners. One MP said it would result in bigger government and a higher welfare bill. And this small government camp describes a GST increase as the lazy option. But they're worried the Treasurer, Scott Morrison, has made up his mind in favour. He's on a horse that's bolted and he might need to perform an awkward dismount, one said. But they say they're confident the Prime Minister knows of their concerns and he's aware that many in the party room would be prepared to reject a GST increase.
That report from Louise Yaxley. Syrian peace talks underway in Geneva have been suspended by the UN because of what it says is a lack of progress. The move follows a significant military advance by Syrian government forces around the rebel-held city of Aleppo. Backed by Russian airstrikes, the government forces have succeeded in cutting vital rebel supply routes. Our Middle East correspondent Matt Brown knows the area well, and I spoke to him earlier. Matt, the Syrian peace talks have been suspended following an intense military action. What's actually happened?
It centres around Aleppo, the second largest city in Syria. It's in northern Syria, just 60 kilometres from the border with Turkey. The rebels seized around half of it in late 2012, but they've been losing ground to the government, which has been circling around their part of the city. And in the last few days, the government made a concerted push to reach two pro-government villages that had been besieged by the rebels. They were between Aleppo and the Turkish border. Now the government has retaken those villages and they've cut a key rebel supply line between Turkey and Aleppo. So it's a significant development on the ground, one of the biggest blows to the rebels in the last 3.5 years.
Well, indeed, it sounds like it's an incredibly significant development for the Syrian government. Well, how's it going to change the war?
It's substantial because of that supply line. It demonstrates the power of Russian airstrikes, because the UN says that they were unprecedented in this operation. It's also cut the rebels off from supplies of food, fuel, ammunition, weapons and fighters that they were getting down that supply route from Turkey. In 2013, I drove down to Aleppo from the north, a little further to the east than where this has happened, in what is now territory controlled by the Islamic State group. And earlier I had hiked in further to the west across the border into the towns west of Aleppo. We slept in the same houses as foreign fighters, actually, who were also crossing in. And the government is now pushing in that direction. So it just gives you some idea of how cut off the rebels in Aleppo are becoming. That's underlined the power also of Iranian advisers, the pro-government militias and those Russian airstrikes. And the rebels say it proves that the government isn't serious about those peace talks.
Well, the peace talks themselves, as we've said, have been suspended, certainly haven't been successful so far. It is hard to see in this environment how they could ever succeed.
Well, that's right. They were already halting. Remember, there was a lot of debate about who could and could not attend on behalf of the rebels because they are so fractured and there are some violent extremist groups so prominent amongst them, like the Islamic State group and the al-Qaeda allied Jabhat al-Nusra. While they were excluded, others who attended were still controversial in the eyes of Russia and the Syrian government. And the talks that started to get underway at the start of the week were only talks about talks anyway. They weren't going to be sitting in the same rooms, and even that couldn't be sustained. The UN envoy on Syria, Stefan de Mistura, has suspended those talks now until February 25, saying more work needs to be done, and he's appealed to the major powers who are backing the warring sides to do more to get them to the table.
Middle East correspondent Matt Brown there. To finance, Wall Street has bounced back to be 1.2% higher after a 6% rally in the price of crude oil. Earlier, US stocks were weaker than expected after expansion in the US services sector. The Australian share market is now set to open higher after losing $33 billion in value yesterday because of the lower oil price. The Australian dollar has surged. It's up 2% at 71.8 US cents. That's AM for today. I'm Michael Brissenden. It's 7:30.